America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is The Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day for a great rescue of a great political institution. What institution? The Republican Party. Now, there are a lot of people out there who believe the Republicans are doing just fine. They've been able to curb some of Joe Biden's most extreme and excessive spending proposals, his most dramatic expansions of government. And they've hit on a couple of issues where the American people seem to be on their side. For instance, voter ID, tightening up our elections to make them more secure, and above all, preventing critical race theory and an America-hating curriculum from taking root in our public schools, which is going to be a potent issue in the future. But Chris Christie, a former governor of New Jersey, former presidential candidate, former very effective federal prosecutor, thinks the GOP needs rescue. His new book, which is coming out in November, some months from now, is called Republican Rescue, the subtitle Saving the Party from Truth Deniers, Conspiracy Theorists, and the Dangerous Policies of Joe Biden. Governor, an honor to speak to you again.
Michael, so great to be back on the program. Thanks for having me.
What a joy. Okay, so what do you say to people who say, look, the Republicans are doing just fine, the party's not in trouble, when you're not in trouble, you don't need rescue? To that you say?
To that I say that between 2018 and 2020, in those 2 years, we lost the House of Representatives, the United States Senate, and the White House for the first time in a two-year period since Herbert Hoover. I don't think people would have said the Republican Party was in good shape after Herbert Hoover. And we watch what's happening now. And yes, we are being able, through the filibuster and other tactics, to be able to slow Joe Biden down a little bit. But let's face it, he could push through $3, $4, $5, $6 trillion in additional spending and social programs that will change the face of American capitalism forever with just a 50-50 vote in the Senate and Vice President Harris as the tiebreaker. This is not what we need as a country, and only the Republican Party can stand up to save American freedom and American capitalism.
Okay, you talk about truth deniers, and you're not now talking about people on the Democratic side. You're talking about people within the party. That's what the subtitle says. You say saving the party from truth deniers. What truths are prominent Republicans denying?
Well, listen, there's been all kinds of truth denying, Michael. As you know, over the last number of years, whether it's coming from places like QAnon, whether it's coming from kind of the ridiculous Pizzagate conspiracy that was all over the internet for a long period of time and that many people in our party followed and believed without any factual basis. And we've had a denial of the fact that, like it or not, and believe me, I was the first major person to support Donald Trump in 2016. I prepped him for the debates in 2016. I chaired his transition committee. I chaired his opioid and drug abuse commission, and I prepped him for the 2020 debates. I was as disappointed as anybody that he lost in 2020, but lose he did. And our party needs to stop looking in the rearview mirror and start looking through the windshield again to solve the problems that exist in this country and to stop Joe Biden and the Democrats.
Okay, so in terms of beyond stopping Joe Biden and the Democrats and looking forward, what should the Republicans look forward to? I mean, people talk a lot about what we shouldn't do. What should we do to inspire America? Could Republicans benefit by something like the Contract with America, a positive program for the congressional candidates next year?
We absolutely could benefit by something like that, Michael. And let's talk about some of the things that we need to be standing up for. We need to be standing up for an public educational system in this country that cares more about the education of our children and less about the comfort of the adults who teach them. We need to be standing up for teaching that there are many, many, many more things in this country to be proud of about being an American than there are mistakes that have been made by Americans. Yet we have all these things like critical race theory and the American dream being a myth, all being taught regularly now in our public school system and being advocated for by the teachers' unions, the NEA and the AFT, which are just subsidiaries and funders of the Democratic Party. We need to start having a completely different policy towards our adversaries around the world. Russia, where we had years now of coddling and trusting Vladimir Putin while he interferes in our elections, invades Crimea, threatens Ukraine, supports Assad in Syria. We need to stand up to Vladimir Putin, not just say nice things about him. Well, we need to stop saying nice things and treating China as if they're not our number one adversary for the next 50 years. We need to be doing things in North Korea which take money and power away from Kim Jong-un directly, putting sanctions on him, not the North Korean people, but taking the money that he's stolen from the North Korean people and has secreted around the world. We know where that money is. We need to take Kim Jong-un's money. That will get his attention. And we need not to get back into this Iranian nuclear deal, but stand up for three principles. One, that Iran can never have a nuclear weapon. Two, that missile technology has to be a part of any deal. And anytime, anywhere inspections have to be a part of any deal with the Iranians. How about we just start there, Michael, and we can go on for another hour.
Well, that sounds good. But one thing that you have actually made great sense on in the past, and I've applauded you for it, was calling not just for lowering taxes, not just for limiting the Biden tax increases, but for tax simplification, giving Americans a kind of tax system where it's not such an agony every damn year when you have to go through this. Wouldn't that unite and inspire a lot of Republicans who may have given up on making the IRS more reasonable?
It sure would. And you're right that I've advocated for that and advocated for taxes being fair across the board for all Americans. What do we mean by that? In high tax states like my own or New York or California, we shouldn't be subsidizing those states. And that's why the change in deductibility of state and local taxes was the right thing to do. Every step we can take to make taxes simpler and fairer are things that I've advocated for in the past and continue to advocate for as part of our party's future. And the Democrats, by contrast, want to make the IRS bigger and more powerful and to be going after people. It's hard for me to believe that the Democrats really think it's a winning strategy that the American people want a bigger, more powerful, more intrusive IRS. We want an IRS that collects the taxes that are owed by the American people in a fair and simple way.
And in terms of taxes being collected in a fair and simple way, it's just something that struck me that was in the New York Times yesterday, which was they do a thing where they do sort of luxury houses every year. And they're talking about a house in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, a nice place, that was going for $1.3 million, but that would require in state property taxes, state and local property taxes, $43,000 a year. Doesn't that strike you as a little bit punishing, where home ownership is a dream of so many Americans?
It's really punishing, and that's why the people inside those individual states and municipalities have to hold their governments accountable for those kind of things. That's why when I was governor of New Jersey, we capped property tax increases at no greater than 2% a year and capped the salary increases of public sector employees at no more than 2% a year. That makes sense, and that's the kind of thing that can control taxes over the long term. And in some of these states that are exorbitant in terms of their taxes, we need to be getting much smarter about reducing those taxes, because you're right, they are an absolute barrier to young people being able to own homes.
Chris Christie, his new book coming out a couple of months is called Republican Rescue. Always provocative and making sense. We will be right back on the MedVed Show.
And in a world that is as dangerous, as frightening as any time I've seen it in my lifetime, there is only one indispensable force for good in the world.
The Michael Medved Show.
I think he actually had in mind a force even larger than our show, the United States of America, that Governor Christie during his presidential campaign, which didn't do that well, but he is always an articulate and forceful advocate of core conservative philosophy, and I salute him for it. And part of what he said over the weekend on ABC this week had to do with the Texas voting law, which we had just been describing and discussing. And Governor Christie said this on ABC. Listen.
The rhetoric here outstrips what's actually being done. Let's look at the Texas bill. The existential threat to voting is by saying we can't have 24-hour voting or drive-through voting. That's an existential threat when, in addition, you're adding more days of early voting, you're adding more drop boxes. That's all in the Texas law.
It's when you make it criminal. That's not an existential.
Donna.
Come on.
Not being able to drive through vote or vote in 24-hour periods is an existential threat to voting. This is not that. That's not this.
Okay. And look, I think that's basically what he is talking about here. He said another statement he made on this subject was liberal rhetoric totally mischaracterizes the state of voting rights in this country. We must push back and tell the American people the truth. Republicans want every legal voter to be able to cast a legal vote for the candidate of their choice. Dems are not telling you the truth. I think that is true. I know what Governor Christie says there. I know that there are a lot of people listening, and you're correct. I pointedly did not ask him, are you running for president? I think the answer to that one is duh. Of course he is. I mean, you don't have a book that comes out in November, right a year before the election, and a book called Republican Rescue without seeing yourself as a potential rescuer. I think it's fairly obvious. He has also answered a question. He said he is making the decision about whether he's going to run or not, and he's not going to wait on Donald Trump's decision. I think that's because, like a lot of other people, including Vice President Pence, he assumes that President Trump probably will not run. And I would guess that is the right assumption, though anyone who wants to try to predict with any reliability what the course of action is going to be for President Trump, that's a risky bet. There is somebody who ran for not president, but for mayor of New York City, who actually won. Eric Adams is all but mayor-elect. He still has the formality of a general election. I think it's very unlikely that in a city where Democrats outnumber Republicans 7-1, that Curtis Sliwa, his formidable and estimable opponent, who's been a guest on this show, I don't think Curtis is going to be able to undo the Democratic nominee, and that's now official with the results of that ranked choice, ridiculous election. Eric Adams is now going to be the Democratic nominee. So he was making the rounds, of course, on Sunday, and he was on with George Stephanopoulos and talking a little bit about the challenge of crime and what to do with it, which is the biggest challenge facing any new mayor. This is clip 13.
Cities are hurting all across America, and New York personifies that pain, the inequalities, the gun violence, the lack of really looking after everyday blue-collar workers, I like to say. And we have failed for so many years, and we've allowed the fallout of the Trump administration to have an overreach in philosophy and not on-the-ground real issues that are facing everyday New Yorkers.
So is it fair to call you an anti-woke Democrat?
No, some of us never went to sleep. That's the problem. You know, a 35-year record of fighting for reform, for public safety, a person who was arrested by police, assaulted by police, but also lost a childhood friend to gang violence. And so I never went to sleep. And people who have finally realized that there are issues out here believe they can carve the entire Democratic agenda.
Okay. He was also on Sunday on CNN with Jake Tapper. And it's refreshing to hear a Democrat, especially one who is about to become America's most prominent mayor, actually criticizing the priorities of his own party. Clip 15.
The priorities of national Democrats may have been misplaced.
Yes, I do. I believe those priorities, they really were misplaced. And it's almost insulting what we have witnessed over the last few years. Many of our presidents, they saw these numbers. They knew that the inner cities, particularly where black, brown, and poor people lived, they knew they were dealing with this real crisis. And it took this president to state that it is time for us to stop ignoring what is happening in the south sides of Chicago's, in the Brownsville's, in the Atlantas of our city, of our country. And so it is extremely important that just as we became energetic after we saw mass shootings with assault rifles in the suburban parts of our country, which we should have also focused on the handgun. The numbers of those who are killed by handguns are astronomical. And if we don't start having real federal legislation matched with states and cities, we're never going to get this crisis under control.
Okay, and which is a problematic statement. And again, I wish Eric Adams well. But it's extraordinarily foolish when you're talking about crime in a city where you control the police department, you control law enforcement, you are responsible for public safety. You can't rely on Washington. We don't have a federal police force. And yes, the federal government, various agencies of the federal government, including the FBI, can be helpful. But the idea that, we're not going to get anything done until the federal government moves against handguns is just Democratic pablum and makes very little sense. I'll tell you what does make sense, and it actually is a poll that sounds right to me. You can tell me if you disagree. But it's a poll published in Politico, and it's a Politico Harvard Ipsos poll. And it shows that Americans are almost evenly divided over whether schools or private employers should require COVID-19 vaccinations as part of reopening. Most Democrats support forcing employees and students to be vaccinated before they return to work or their classroom and approve of government-issued documents certifying their status. Republicans oppose the government or most employers infringing on their individual choice about the vaccine. The survey lands as Biden administration officials desperate to turn the country's rapidly declining vaccination rates around are barnstorming the country, pleading with people to take the shot. So what happens if they don't? And what's the alternative strategy for dealing with the remainder of the pandemic? On the Michael Medved show, markets have been great. The economy looking strong. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up more than 100 points again today. All of that is good news. What is not good news is the sharply dropping rate of vaccinations. And whether you believe that the vaccination is good for you or right for you or not, that's your decision. But is there any real question that one of the things that this nation desperately needs is more protection against COVID-19 and particularly some of these truly horrible and very highly infectious variants? And they seem to indicate that the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines are both fairly effective even against the Delta variant, which is so very contagious. But they have this piece in Politico about the political aspects of this. I think that any effort to play this as a political issue, something that should separate Republicans versus Democrats, What sense does that make if you don't buy into some kind of idea that the entire COVID-19 is a political conspiracy? Which, by the way, there are no grounds for believing. I mean, President Trump got sick, as did Governor Christie, by the way, we just had on. History got very sick, and they got better. They were effectively treated, and they both have gotten vaccinated afterward. Why would people remain on such a political note? Now, this poll that I mentioned to you, where it says Americans sharply divided over vaccination mandates, they're divided over whether where you work or a local government should require that you get the vaccine. They're not divided over whether the vaccine is a good idea or it works or anything of that nature. And they point out in this poll that there was bipartisan support for vaccinating teachers and healthcare workers. The survey found that 70% of all respondents and 56% of Republicans with school-aged children thought public schools should require teachers to be vaccinated. Similarly, 66% of respondents and 59% of Republicans favored healthcare institutions requiring their employees to get the shot. There is also broad support for requiring proof of vaccination before boarding flights or cruise ships. Obviously, that is because those are settings people know that you're going to be inside and in close proximity to one another for a period of time. Most Americans oppose requiring vaccinations to attend a sporting event or to enter a store. Okay. The division here, by the way, if you look at the numbers are not quite as sharply different between Republicans and Democrats as some previous surveys have shown. In other words, it is true that of the 20 states with the highest percentage of people who've received vaccines, those are all states that were won by Joe Biden. Does that mean that this has a D on it for Democrat, the vaccine that you receive, or has Joe Biden's name on it? I don't think it does in any sense. And I do wonder what those people, and you write to me, and I know you're there, and I respect your point of view, and good luck to you. And of course, this is ultimately an individual decision. But for those people who don't want to get vaccinated, how is the virus supposed to be defeated? How does the pandemic end? How do we get herd immunity without having a much higher rate of infection and medical costs and people need to be hospitalized and far more? On CBS News, Dr. Anthony Fauci spoke about the reluctance of people to get their vaccines. And Dr. Fauci, of course, much less popular than he was at the beginning of the pandemic. And given the fact that, in general, this has not been a complete disaster, the government handling of this, it hasn't. The vaccines were developed far more rapidly than anyone thought would be possible. And the majority of Americans have now at least gotten one vaccine. But Dr. Fauci said this about the vaccine resistance. Listen.
99.5% of all the deaths to COVID-19 are in unvaccinated people. So you're talking about something that's life-saving. So the idea of why some people, for whatever reasons, and we know some of them are ideological, we know when you look geographically in the situations where you have under-vaccinated states, where you have 30% or less of the people vaccinated, we've really got to get beyond that. And we've got to put those kinds of differences aside and say this is a public health issue. when you hear people at rallies talking, don't get vaccinated, don't get vaccinated, John, it doesn't make any sense because we're talking about a public health issue that is life-saving for you, your family, as well as your community. So you're right, we are in a very difficult position. We have more vaccines in this country than we know what to do with. Everybody and anybody can get vaccinated, and we have people throughout the world who would do anything to get vaccinated because they appreciate the importance of safeguarding their health. So it's a very, very frustrating situation.
And it's children's health as well. I mean, particularly with the new variants, apparently there are a large number, not as much as adults or elderly people, but there are a large number of young people, people in their teens, people 12 years old, who are getting ill. My question for anybody out there, and we'll take a call on this at 1-800-955-1776. For those people who are passionately determined not to get a vaccine, how is this supposed to play out? We are not near herd immunity. It's not going to peter out the way it did after we suffered 675,000 deaths with the Spanish flu in an America that was about a third as large as it is today. So we had this devastating death toll in 1918. And the death toll helped to produce herd immunity because there's so many people who died and so many people who got the disease and managed to survive it. Okay, are we looking at another, could be 50 million, 100 million people to get COVID? Because the people who don't want the vaccine are not in favor of more social distancing or more mask wearing or more restrictions. Certainly not. We've already suffered a devastating financial cost for the restrictions, and we're just getting better about it because of the vaccines. And see, one of the questions that I think people have to ask is, okay, if you take a look at the rate of infection, why has it gone down so dramatically if these vaccines don't work? And why would it be that, and no one has questioned these statistics, that at least 99.5% of the new cases of COVID, of the new fatalities of COVID, have been among unvaccinated people. It is worth talking about, though, the idea of going door to door and trying to persuade people in person with door to door visits that President Biden talked about. That's a scary idea, and it just will put people further off. We will. And on the Michael Medved Show, a big headline today in the New York Times, it said England fails to end 55 years of despair. Now, look, I understand Britain has had its problems in the last half century, but is 55 years of despair for Great Britain, that would include the Thatcher era, that would include some moments of real triumph for the Brits, no? And, okay, what they're talking about, of course, is soccer and the fact that the Three Lions, which is the name of the British football team, soccer team, lost with a penalty kick overtime. People who like soccer, you understand all of this about what happened in the match on the pitch in Wembley. And I'm sorry the Brits lost. There's another story from sports, but I think to talk about 55 years of despair because they failed to win the European Championship all that time could be a little bit of an overstatement, and it could be a little bit of an overstatement to accuse the Denver authorities, who are virtually all Democrats, very Democratic city, of Nazi-like tactics by cleaning out some homeless encampments surrounding the ball field where they are going to be playing, the stadium where they're going to be playing the All-Star game, Major League All-Star game, tomorrow night, which should be fairly amazing. The whole world watching Shohei Ohtani, of course, and more. And good luck to both American and National League. Let us go to Lee in Olympia, where, Lee, we can take solace in the fact that Kikuchi, at least, is representing the Mariners. But go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, Michael. How are you?
I'm very well.
You were talking about vaccine hesitancy, and I just wanted to speak to that and kind of explain at least how I see it.
Sure,
we
go ahead.
Manipulated by our politicians on both sides when Trump was in office and he was coming up with the whole vaccine plan. Democrats were, no, won't take it, can't do it. When Biden gets into office, then he's pushing and he's all for it. Now the Republicans are against it. Our media has been lying to us. They lie to us constantly about, you know, the summer of love and there's no... There's no violence in the streets. It's really hard to know what honest is anymore. And I think people, when you don't trust, you won't make a decision at all. It's not that you're pro-vaccine or against vaccines. It's just you don't trust anybody in the information.
Yeah, I think you speak for a lot of people, Lee. And I certainly understand what you're saying. And this entire thing was politicized. And I do think, by the way, that President Trump did a very problematic course of action when he started doing those daily briefings, which were always full of great exaggerated tales of progress. The truth of the matter is, though, he did succeed with the Project Warp Speed. We got vaccines earlier than anyone expected that we would. And my question to you would be, With your distrust of politicians, do you also distrust doctors?
A little bit, but I'm not vaccinated, and my reasoning is if the vaccine works, and you just said, 99.5% of the fatalities are from non-vaccinated people. If you're vaccinated, then you shouldn't be so worried about what I'm doing.
Well, the reason I'm worried about it, Lee, is what I was talking about before. I don't want this to be the forever virus. I want it to be done. I want it to be a chapter in American history, like the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918-1919. And it seems very likely that the medical professionals are right. Without mass vaccinations and continuing vaccinations, here and around the world, this is going to continue to be a tragic element of human life that we don't need, right?
Well, don't you also believe that, you know, true to the way a virus works, is that these variants are less potent, even though they're more communicable, they are less potent.
They can still kill you and they can still put you in the hospital.
Yeah, so can a lot of things, Michael.
Right, I know, but we don't have a lot of things that we can prevent like this. For instance, measles vaccines. There are people out there who are opposed to that. There's an anti-vaxxer community, I guess. But it's incredibly foolish. I mean, smallpox, I was talking about this actually over the weekend. Smallpox was an incomparable killer. I mean, they estimate that perhaps as many as 90% of the Native American population in the Northeast United States died of smallpox. And it was devastating. And we cured it. Smallpox is no longer a problem because of what? Vaccines. So polio would be another example, where it's changed. Why wouldn't we want to protect ourselves from this particular threat? It won't be the last one.
Again, it goes to lack of trust in almost every system that's out there right now, medical, political, media.
I think you're right to have distrust in the political system and distrust in the the media delivery. And but you see, the point is, you have a lot of choice in media, which can help make up for that. You also have a lot of choice as to which medical sources you want to believe, but they seem to be unanimous on the importance and effectiveness of the vaccine. And why do you think the rate of illness and death has gone down so dramatically since December?
I think it's a combination of many things. It has to do with the most vulnerable, probably foremost, being vaccinated. So taking that. And then the secondary people, the people who are in my age group, who are older but were in good health, getting vaccinated. I'm a mom. My kids are vaccinated. They have all their childhood things taken care of, and I fully support that.
So, then why not this? I don't get it. Why should this be different? If your kids got tetanus shots and measles shots and the other shots that you get, why would you resist this shot?
I had the COVID.
Oh, okay. Okay, then.
I've had flus that were way worse for me. I had a little bit of a headache, and I had a loss of taste, and that was about it. My whole family.
Have you gotten your taste back?
Yeah, it took a little bit over a month. I had like only salt I could taste.
Okay. Look, obviously you are at very low risk with there are many people who get the disease once and they get it again and it's less or sometimes it's more, and I hope you stay protected from it. But when you're talking about, aside from your individual case, Lee, when you're talking about the country at large, I think it really is worth thinking about, okay, so what's the alternative? Or do we just let people get sick when we know we can prevent it? I don't think that's moral. I don't think it's patriotic. There is a new movie out there that a new movie out there that is called.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
Director Steven Soderbergh assembles a great ensemble cast for a moody thriller about petty crooks in 1954 Detroit, who get drawn into a series of world-changing mysteries in No Sudden Move. Now playing in theaters and streaming on HBO Max.
The problem is, you're not smart enough to know how not smart you are.
Why are you doing this, man?
Because I'm going to get what's mine.
That's Don Cheadle, who along with Benicio del Toro is at the center of the action, along with the likes of Ray Liotta, Matt Damon, and John Hamm. The plot, which features some conspiratorial maneuvers in the auto industry, is intricate and intriguing. But the real power of this picture comes from the characterizations, which are consistently convincing and complex. It's rated R for rough language, some sex references, and disturbing violence that's plausible, but never over the top. 3 stars for No Sudden Move, a supremely skillful piece of work that leaves you wondering about the deeper dimensions of what you've just seen. And next time on the Medved Show, we have another update with Matt Damon saying his life was changed by his research in a Trump supporter that he's playing in a new movie. And more sex, fewer fights, all because of COVID, next time on the Medved.